Hello and welcome to Healing From Within on WebTalkRadio.net. I am your host, Cheryl Glick, Energy Alignment Practitioner and author of Life is No Coincidence. This radio show addresses ways to master and properly utilize our thoughts and interactions with our modern-day world for the supreme purpose of living a holistic and healthier lifestyle. Joining me today is Dr. Larry Rosen, author of Eye Disorder, a book that reveals how our regular use of technology can cause us to show symptoms of psychological disorders and what we can do to utilize and understand both the positive and negative aspects of technology in our fast-changing world of gadgets and social networks that are now part of our daily lives. Hello, Dr. Rosen.
Hello. Thank you for having me on your show today.
Oh, I'm very excited to talk about this topic. It's very timely and very important. So let's tell our listeners something about your background. Dr. Rosen is a renowned expert on the psychology of technology and a past chair and professor at California State University, and a research psychologist who over the past 25 years have studied more than 30,000 children, teens, college students, and adults in the United States and 23 other countries to find ways to harmonize our physical and psychological health with the constant influx of information now being downloaded to us via, well, we've got the internet, we've got cell phones, Blackberries, iPods, texting, tweeting, posting on Facebook, and so on. And Dr. Rosen in his book explains that the flow of this constant information is more than the human mind was meant to handle, and perhaps that there is little difference between Blackberry addicts and those suffering from obsessive compulsive disorder and other mood disorders. So I feel today we are going to try to awaken the public to the realization that a dependence on technology has really gone beyond convenience and is becoming a dehumanizing obsession that permeates and threatens our humanity. And it may be a necessary conclusion that you will make at the end of today's episode. Larry, it is clear to me that many clients and people around me are so involved with their video games and their communication via machines that they appear to me to be losing a lot of their ability to communicate thoughts and ideas to relatives, spouses, and children, friends, business association. And I sort of feel and sense as an energy healer, many are in states of anxiety, fear, depression, and a general dissatisfaction with their relationships. Can you comment on what you've observed in relation to this, relationship to this?
Sure. And you've actually just hit on almost all of the issues in the book. Because what we have found through all of our research is that all of these little eye devices, the iPod, the iPhones, the Wiis, and the eye in front of eye disorder, thank you, Steve Jobs, for that one, that people are enjoying their technology. They're enjoying their wireless mobile devices, which, by the way, we call WMDs for a good reason, because in many cases we're finding that these are sort of weapons of mass destruction.
Oh.
And the destruction comes when we start to act out of anxiety and feel as though if we don't check in with our devices, if we don't text someone back immediately, if we don't make that comment on Facebook immediately, that we will be missing out. And so what we are seeing is that people are acting as though they are just like Jack Nicholson on As Good As It Gets in the movie, where he is constantly locking and unlocking the doors and turning on and turning off the faucets and having to use specific silverware and having to have things exactly the way they want it. We are doing the same with our phones. We are padding our pockets all day long. We are worrying, oh, did I leave my phone someplace? Is my phone on? Is it off? Ooh, what has happened since the last time I checked it 2 minutes ago? And particularly among young people is where we're seeing this happen more and more. And I'm not talking just about teenagers. It's preteens and young adults, college students, and that doesn't exempt us older people like me who is a baby boomer. I do the same thing. I am feeling compelled.
Well, you know, I'm a baby boomer, too, and I remember somewhere in the book you mentioned that you yourself, when you're in a restaurant or with the family, are still also picking up the equipment and using it. Now, I don't do that. I am, when I'm working, I need to do it. And if I miss a call, I feel that they'll get back to me sooner or later. And maybe it's because I am so sensitive to energy, and it does make me a little anxious when it's all bombarding me at one time. So I make a conscious effort to use it as a tool, and that's just what it should be seen as, a tool. And we need to have times when we can disengage.
But, you know, the interesting thing is that, yes, on the one hand it is a tool, but we now know from all of our research that it is not being perceived as a tool anymore. It is somewhat like we don't think of air as being a tool to help us breathe and our bodies to live. We just accept that when we walk outside, when we wake up in the morning, we take a breath, there will be air. The younger generations take technology the same way. They look at technology as though it is just part and parcel of their everyday existence. So the fact that they feel compelled to check it in the middle of a restaurant dinner is not a problem for them. And, in fact, most of them feel, if you ask them, oh, yeah, I can check my phone and I can listen to the conversation at the same time. It's not a problem. The problem comes when the checking becomes obsessive, when you're checking every minute, every 2 minutes, every 5 minutes. And I laugh at myself a lot, and I say, well, I'm the one who, you know, dinner in a restaurant, I get probably 500 email messages a day, and after 15 minutes at dinner in a restaurant, I will often excuse myself to go to the restroom, really not to go to the restroom, but to check my phone to see if anything really important has come in the last...
But at least you're excusing yourself, and you're taking it away from people who might be disrupted or disturbed by it. So that's the proper etiquette, and there seems to be that we need to have some rules so that we can help ourselves deal with the need to use it as a tool, because it is a tool, and the air is a tool, and we can't live without it at this point, but we have to live with it, I think, in the best way. Now, I know you and your colleagues were involved with over 766 participants, and that was baby boomers and Generation Xers and Net Generation and so on, all people from different age categories and from a wide range of educational levels, occupations, and socioeconomic statuses. And this test was to determine whether the level of someone's psychological health might be related to the types of technology used and the amount of time invested. Can you tell us something about this study and the term, I believe you used, techno-stress?
Right. This is actually one study of probably 30 or 40 that we've done in the last 5 years. But this one was the one that was turned out to be the impetus for the book. There are measures that psychiatrists and psychologists give to people that list questions, yes or no questions, this question is like me, and the result are a list of signs and symptoms of a variety of psychological disorders, ranging from depression to narcissism to schizophrenia to psychosis to different kinds of mood disorders. And what we were interested in looking at is across generations, across ages, because we feel this is not just a young person's problem, across ages, are there any specific kinds of uses of technology that predict more of these signs and symptoms of disorders? And what we found was fascinating. I mean, we did all the appropriate statistical comparisons and everything, and what we found is that the primary culprit turns out to be Facebook use, of all things.
Mm-hmm.
And, for example, those people who use Facebook more, and I don't mean more hours per day, although that is one of the pieces of information we looked at, but I just mean use it more, comment more, post more, like more, do things like that. Those people tended to have more signs and symptoms of narcissistic personality disorder, depression, mania. But then there were some interesting results. For example, having more Facebook friends meant you were more likely to have narcissistic personality disorder signs. You were more likely to have signs of say, antisocial behavior, but you were less likely to be depressed.
Mm-hmm.
So on the one hand, having more Facebook friends means you're probably going to be less depressed too. So it's a little complex, but what we're finding is that more use of technology can lead to potential problems. We call it an eye disorder because it's not really a disorder yet, but it's the ramifications of using all these little eye gadgets too much.
Well, in the book, you have already touched on this. You discuss several common psychiatric disorders, such as communication disorders, and this includes antisocial personality disorders, social phobias, autism, Asperger's, attention deficit hyperactivity, depression, obsessive compulsive, and you really touch narcissistic was another one I was very interested in, hypochondrias and schizotypical disorders, voyeurism, and addiction. And you really did a wonderful job of explaining some of the symptoms and behavior, because often in life we're interacting with people and sometimes we have challenges in doing that, and sometimes we might take something personally and think we offended someone when they don't act socially acceptable to our input. And so the thing is, you did a good job in showing a lot of behavior that's out there, and whether it's been stimulated by technology or whether the fast-moving pace of our world right now is exasperating a lot of these tendencies. Many people, I believe, are showing tendencies. They might not be full-blown, but they are tendencies that need to be worked with and to help people be comfortable in their body and to live the most active and proactive life that they can. So you talked about narcissistic personality disorder and how our technological culture is causing many children and adults to be developing some symptoms. It doesn't mean they're full-blown into this pattern, but it is seemingly there are more people being predisposed toward this behavior. So could you tell us something a little bit about that disorder and some of the symptoms?
Sure. One of the things that's interesting is pretty much if you ask anybody what a narcissist is, they know. They'll say, oh, it's a person who cares only about themselves. Well, it is really more than that. It's a person who touts himself or herself as being special, who collects friends that help him feel more special, has grandiose ideas about his or her place in the world, and wants to let everyone know constantly how great he is. The interesting thing is that social media, whether it be Facebook, LinkedIn, Twitter, is a perfect platform for the narcissist to display his narcissism. And there have been some very clever studies done by other researchers as well as my own lab. And one of them simply looked at people who are on Facebook and gave them an assessment measure that told how narcissistic they were. And by the way, that assessment instrument is in the book, so people can test their own level of narcissism. And then they read their posts and looked at their comments that they made. And those who were more narcissistic ended up using the words I and me way more often than we, they, us, them, any kind of collective pronoun. And so this is a sign that you may be exhibiting signs and symptoms of a psychiatric disorder. And like you said, very appropriately, may not be full-blown, but it's something that needs to be attended to before you slip into a narcissistic personality disorder.
Right, because, I'm sure we have all in our working career been in places where we've had to deal with people who exhibit this. I know I have. And I know when a narcissist is threatened or fears that they are not getting enough attention, they can have pretty violent outbreaks. Do you think that narcissists gravitate towards this love affair with Facebook because they need it? Or does Facebook fuel and enlarge some people with some narcissistic characteristics to increase this tendency?
Can my answer be C, all of the above?
I was going to say
both. It is all of the above. It can either give you a platform to all of a sudden go, oh, I can tout myself on here, Or if you already are the kind of person that has some of the narcissistic personality traits, then it may exacerbate it and make it worse.
Yes, I agree. I agree. And in watching people use the machines in places that I go and people that I am aware have certain tendencies, I'm seeing just what you're saying. It becomes very visible to people who are interested in holistic health feelings of what's good for people, because they have a sensitivity to energy and what's happening around them, that there's a great deal of this right now going on. Now, I know there was a study in your book that you said Christopher Lotens did, and he questioned parents. They were trying to determine more about what parenting practices encourage the development of abnormal narcissistic behavior. And I'm very interested in this because I see a lot of children coming past me with lots of sensitivities, and I would like the parents to know what they can do to avoid some of these pitfalls. So tell us what parenting practices might encourage this type of behavior?
Okay, and I am a strong advocate of good parenting.
Mm-hmm.
My training is in the child development area, and I speak to parent groups all over the world often. So let me give you my philosophy on parenting in this high-tech generation, because this is really crucial. We cannot just start handing our one-year-olds an iPad and go, ooh, look how much he enjoys that, look how exciting it is, without starting the conversation. And so my philosophy of parenting is that as soon as you allow your child to use any form of media, that it is mandatory that you have once a week family meetings,
mm-hmm.
even if they're just 1 year old. And what that means is you sit on the floor so that you're all at about the same relative height, so there's no big power thing of mommy and daddy towering over their
mm-hmm.
child. And then you have to spend, depending upon the age of the child, anywhere from just a few minutes to maybe 15 minutes at the most, and talk about technology. But really, the parent's job is not talking. The parent's job is listening. So,
and
for example,
I think, Larry, the parent's job is also being a good role model and using their machines and equipment appropriately, so the children don't just hear what to do, they see what to do.
Yes, and I will get to that. But yes, that is really important. I agree with you. These meetings, though, are designed for the parent to ask a question or two and then sit back and listen. So if I were meeting with my 12-year-old, for example, what I might say to them is, so tell me, what interesting apps have you downloaded on your phone this week? What's fun about them? And then your parent zip their lips, sit back, listen, smile on their face, non-judgmental,
mm-hmm.
and just use their parent radar to make sure that your kids aren't having any problems. And what you do is do this week in, week out, from when they're little until they're big. What you're trying to do is to develop trust with your kids so that when something bad does happen, they will come talk to you. And the kinds of conversations you have when they're 12, 13 is, hey, I read an article in the paper last week that some kids are cyberbullied. Do you know anybody that's been bullied? What
mm-hmm.
do you think they felt? So you bring up these kind of uncomfortable topics that they wouldn't bring up normally to talk to their parents. But you bring them up in this nice little family setting of 10 to 15 minutes on the floor once a week. It becomes a habit, and it is strong, strong, strong in the development of good family trust.
I think that's great. And I also read in your book that I took note of this. Students who were raised by either a very authoritative mother or father, where rules were rules and parental warmth was largely absent, they had a risk of becoming more narcissistic than those raised by parents who showed warmth and compassion and had no rules, but just, you know, I'm big on focusing on what people do right, being proactive more than I am, and this is with grown-ups or children. I'm not so interested in focusing on negative behavior and judgment. I would rather focus on what people are doing that brings a wonderful feeling of health and compatibility in the relationship. And I think that works better than so many rules. And I believe children have a great wisdom, an innate wisdom, and they know what's good for them. And if you give them the opportunity, they're going to guide you somewhat to realize what they need and what you might need. And it doesn't have to be this battle going on between, I know better because I'm older, I'm your parent, and we will do it this way. You know, you're in my home. That kind of philosophy leads to a lot of, I would believe, mood disorders and emotional problems. But let's go on.
And the strategy of authoritative parenting is very interesting.
Mm-hmm.
Because an authoritative parent has warmth and kindness and understanding, but also sets rules for their kids and does that in conjunction with the kids. So you sit down again in these family meetings, perhaps, and you say, okay, I notice that everybody's using their phones too much at dinner. We need a rule. Let's talk about it. What kind of rules should we have about using phones at family dinner? Should we ban them completely? Should we allow everybody to use them for a minute or two and then check in the middle of dinner? What should we do? And then the authoritative parent discusses it with the family. They come up with a rule, and that becomes the rule.
But that's a community approach to doing what's good for everyone, not just being told to respond and to let go of your own feeling of self-worth or your own belief and confidence system. So, yeah, that's very important, I would think.
And if you are the kind of parent that's the my way or the highway parent, the authoritarian parent, the kids will break the rules.
Of course.
I mean, they're going to consider breaking the rules anyway, because that's what kids do.
Right.
They push the envelope. They're allowed to. That's their job as a child. But there have to be rules that you say, okay, you pushed the envelope. That was this rule. You violated it. Here's the consequence that we discussed as a family, very calmly. Here's the consequence. I'm going to do X, because this is what we said we were going to do. And X should, by the way, the penalty should start out very small, like I'm going to take your phone away for an hour.
Mm-hmm.
And the next time, though, I'm going to double it, and then I'm going to double it again, and then I'm going to double it again. That tends to work really well, because by the time you get to the third or fourth doubling, the kid realizes, oh, my God, I'm going to lose my phone for a day? Oh, no. Whereas if you just say, I'm taking your phone away for a day or a week immediately, they'll find another phone to use. They'll find a friend's phone.
Yes,
and they
absolutely.
They also won't respect those boundaries.
Yeah, everybody wants love and respect. And if we would approach everybody that way, not only in reference to technology and the use of it, we would have great relationships. But let's get on to something else. I believe you said researchers have begun to identify certain personality traits that lead to an increased chance of becoming an addict. Now, by an addict, you mean somebody who's unable to find time to pull away and involve themselves in other things in their life. So you also mentioned harm avoidance. That is, a pre-advocate to this, becoming an addict. So could you tell us something about that?
I've been doing a lot of thinking lately about technology and addiction and compulsion.
Yeah.
And I've been very lucky to meet some very smart neuroscientists over the last few years who have explained to me that there are very clear brain differences in people who are addicted to something versus people who simply feel compelled to do something. And I'm focusing more now on those differences in trying to understand what's going on. So
I think I'm doing the same thing. I'm trying to get a fix on the differences here.
It's a very important question, I think, and it's one I think we're finally able to answer because of neuroscience, interestingly enough. When someone is addicted, what we see in the brain is that when they do the addictive behavior, then there is the release of chemicals in what's called the dopaminergic area, or dopamine, which is related to a feeling of pleasure. So when dopamine is released in the brain, and some people call it a little squirt of dopamine, so when you get a little squirt of dopamine from doing something, you get pleasure. However, when somebody does something out of a compulsion or an obsession, we don't see the squirt of pleasure happen. What we see is a reduction in the areas that focus on anxiety. And so I think we have to separate these two. And I'm very leery now of ever saying that anybody is addicted to the internet or addicted to technology. If they show that they keep coming back to get pleasure from it, then I think it is an addiction. But
okay.
If they're continually doing it because they feel they have to and they don't know why, it's probably a compulsion. and they're probably trying to reduce their anxiety. And
yes.
often I think for kids particularly, but also for adults, the anxiety is feeling like they're missing out on something.
Mm-hmm.
You're missing out on posts on Facebook. You're missing out on somebody's text.
I think my dad, when I was a kid, when I wanted to do something very quickly and couldn't wait, he would say, oh, that's an anxiety neurosis. All right, so we're talking about something like that where people feel compelled to do something fast because they don't want to let time pass them by, right? And they want to be ahead of the game. So
and they don't want to feel the anxiety of letting
yeah,
that time pass by.
Right, absolutely. So I also know that several researchers, we're not going to have time to do this fully, but I want to get this in here, have speculated that technology is reducing our ability to be empathic to others. And I see that as a breakdown in a very human and necessary connection for health and good personal relationships. So I guess, Larry, we want to say that we hope people will begin to use the equipment to advance their thinking, have a good quality of life, and not use it where it will make other people or themselves uncomfortable. So I want to thank you, Dr. Larry Rosen, for your wonderful, timely book, Eye Disorder, which hopefully will help people find a better understanding of the pitfalls of overuse and incorrect use of advanced technological devices. We have shared our concerns for helping parents to assist their children and themselves in the healthy use of modern machines and to be vigilant and aware of mood disorders so proper help can be found when necessary. For further information, go to www.drlarryrosen.com. In summarizing today's episode of Healing From Within, I would like to read what Dr. Larry Rosen wrote. Technology addiction is a real phenomenon and can have serious problems associated with it as an eye disorder. Although internet addiction is the most widely studied form of technology addiction, you can be addicted to other forms and aspects of technology, including text messaging, social networking, and cell phone calls. Addiction is not just about compulsive use, but also withdrawal, relapse, and other symptoms, and some personality types might be prone to technology addiction. As always, it is the viewpoint of this show, Healing From Within, to explore conditions and situations that can enable us as human beings to understand our own personal lives and interactions with others, and also understand the world environment for a healthier use of our resources. Our goal is always to improve ourselves and our interactions with people, whether in person or using technology. And it has been clear in today's discussion that technology is here to stay. But the way we must use it so we can be engaged in a healthy lifestyle has to have some boundaries. I am Cheryl Glick, host of Healing From Within, and please join me to hear other leaders in the field of health, energy medicine, and the dynamics of our human and physical world. Please go to my website, CherylGlick.com, to experience ways to improve the quality of life.